Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Cove.
I'm Kevin Beckham.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Mackey.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spring from the Wallaroos.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. We apologise that it's been a while, but I've been here, there and everywhere in between podcasts, and it's good to be finally back in John's shed.
Yes, welcome home.
Well, thanks very much. Now, I was obviously over at the Women's World Cup and then back for just about 8 days before I headed off to the Asian Games, where I managed to cover 11 sports, John, in 13 days. That was challenging.
How'd you manage that? That's an incredible effort.
There was a lot of reading and a lot of watching videos on YouTube to try and understand, because some of the sports I'd never done before. So I was given shooting, which I'd never done before. I was given fencing, which I'd never done before. Penchak Silat, which
that's the one. What is that?
Penchak Silat is a Southeast Asian martial art, which was predominantly Indonesian. And just to make things complicated, there's over 100 versions of it in Indonesia alone.
So it's a bit like Chinese boxing?
There were various ways in which the medals were up for grabs. So there would be the individual, what you'd call like a sort of kata that you do in karate.
Okay.
So it's the movements. You had to do 100 moves in 3 minutes, and you would do one with a staff, one with dagger, and then the other was freehand, you know, movements and kicks. And then they would do it in pairs.
Yeah.
And you get points for your expression, the aggression, etc. So it's a sort of, I suppose you'd say it's a choreographed fight when you're in the pairs, and then, which was actually really good. I mean, the guys that won the gold were fantastic. And then they had the team. So there's three of you, and you have to be completely synchronized doing all of your moves. And again, you have to get through, I think it's the 100 moves in 3 minutes. And then you go into actual fights.
So they do end up fighting.
Yeah, they do in it. But that the bouts was really frustrating, because you score by hitting the chest and the back and the upper torso.
Yeah.
But you mustn't, the punch must land cleanly. So it can't have partially blocked by your arm. It shouldn't score. But you don't get, the umpire doesn't tell you when someone's scored. So the only time you know someone's scored is at the end of the 3 minute round and all the judges come up. But then they can actually appeal a decision. Uh-huh. And so then all the judges come out onto the court, have a little bit of a chat. They go, duh, 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 and then they make their decision. And it just seemed to be very strange. But then also, so you get one punch, 1 point for a clean punch, 2 points for a clean kick. But then if you take the person down, you get 3 points. And yeah, there was one of the bouts I did, the Malaysian who was the world champion. He was not getting any decisions going his way, and you could see he was getting frustrated. So in the end, he just walked off. He was fighting an Indonesian, and I think he thought, I'm not going to win the gold here. And walked off, accepted the silver, and that was it.
And of course, the sport that I love, hockey, they had the Asian Olympic qualifier, essentially, was the tournament involved there, and that was a turn up because the team that's already qualified, Japan, as hosts for the Olympics, won both, the men and the women.
They did, and look, I mean, that was a big surprise to many, but I think the one thing that I found interesting about that was how the traditional teams that would have been vying, I don't think paid Japan the respect that they deserved. And I think they really underestimated how Japan had played. Now, if we look at the Japan women's team, they were superb. They played really well, didn't lose a game the whole tournament. I don't think anyone could argue with them winning the gold that they deserved. India were very good as well, but I think the difference...
Well, Japan were unlucky at the World Cup as well, Women's World Cup. I mean, they won a game.
Yeah, they were the only Asian team to win a game in their pool, and yet they were the first Asian team to go home because they were in the pool of death. And the problem was, probably they went home on goal difference, and they let in too many goals in their game against Belgium. Now, the interesting thing with Japan, and you look at the Olympics, which are just under 2 years away, I do worry that the defensive line they've got at the moment is a little bit old. Most of the girls in that are 30, 32, or, you know, around that age, and you go, in 2 years' time, they're going to be 34. Yeah. Although you can still play at that level, there's no doubt, but, you know, are they going to be able to get any better, or are they going to be able to maintain their fitness, not get injuries? cope with quick attackers. I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. But look, they thoroughly deserved it. And I think Anthony Farry, the Australian coach, deserves a lot of credit for what he achieved there. The men, it was just sheer determination, I think, really, that got them through in the end in that final, because it looked as if it was Malaysia's.
Well, a little bit of hubris, too, on the side of both Pakistan and India. I mean, the Indian men scored a world record number of goals for a tournament just in the pool stages, and then they thought they were home and hosed, and Malaysia showed them up with a bit of grit and determination.
Yeah, I actually commentated that game, and it was an amazing game. And I don't know if you saw the piece I wrote on notthefootyshow.com, was because I looked at that afterwards, because the amount of times I've done games where you see in hockey the late equaliser scored by a team and they go on and win the shootout.
Yeah.
And it was amazing when I went back over the last year, especially in the men's game, it's close to 70% of the times the team that scores the equaliser in the last quarter in the men's game and then it goes to a shootout will win the shootout.
It's an interesting stat, that one.
But, the women's game, it was slightly less. I think it was around 50% or 54%. But the men's, it's really, really high. And India should have won that game. They should have wrapped it up again, but they just didn't score. And to be fair, Malaysia, I think we've got to give them credit the way they hung in that game. S. Kumar in goal had a fantastic tournament again. And I think some of their other players really stepped up defensively and had an outstanding game against India.
And it's certainly caused a lot of waves in India, that loss.
Whew, yeah.
Didn't they go off?
Well, they did. And I think the media there, people go on about the British press being hard. I think the Indian press and even the Malaysians, after losing that final, got absolutely slaughtered by the press in Malaysia.
I was tipping them to be the unlucky team to miss the quarters. You know, in each side, men and women, there were five teams that were you could look at and say it's going to come from one of those five teams. Someone's missing out, and I thought on the men's side of things it would be Malaysia.
Yeah, I know, and I just think, you know, guys, and when I say this to the media, it's like nobody, unless we know there's betting involved, throws a game deliberately. They all go out there, and if you look at these guys, they are shattered when they lost. Like India were really, really unbelievably shattered.
They would have been.
And you know, they were not talking to anybody because they didn't know what to say. Because, you know, they just didn't, and the truth is they just didn't perform in that game. You know, they had a bad game when you can't afford it.
And that's the beauty of sport, mate. That's why we love it.
Absolutely.
Shall we get on with
We should. I should just mention who our guest is on this show.
Yes.
Our guest is the para triathlete Brant Garvey, who, if you remember, we followed him from day one.
Yep.
And, you know, when he was getting the money for his new prosthetic leg to start running and doing the triathlons, and how he fell over the first time he ran with it in the park. But his event now has just been cut from the Paralympics. Mm. And I just think that's disgraceful when you're less than 2 years out from the Olympic Games to suddenly make a decision. That decision needed to be made a long, long time earlier. And we'll talk to him about the effect it's had on sponsors, what it's going to do. Will there be changes now? Will the Australian Paralympic Committee, for example, step up now and actually say to the IPC, guys, we can't do this again. This cannot happen because it's wrong. But that's Brant Garvey, and he'll be on the show later. Now, am I starting us off?
Yeah, you go for it.
All right, well, there's been a lot happening since we were last here. But my first one is a bugbear, as you know, I've had it for a long time. So we've had the whole Serena Williams situation at the US Open.
Don't call it Serena Gate.
I wasn't going to call it that.
Calls it Serena Gate.
I wasn't going to call it that. There's no conspiracy here, although she feels otherwise. But anyway, my big thing here is she got fined $17,000 for her behaviour, and it was deemed unsporting or bringing the game into disrepute.
Yep.
Now, $17,000 when her career earnings are $84 million is like you finding me 5 cents if I've said something wrong. It is pathetic. It is offensive, I think, to fans. And I think these world bodies have got to start looking at this and going, hang on a sec, now this is not acceptable. And what they're doing is they are putting the superstars ahead of the sport.
Oh, absolutely.
And to me, I was always brought up that no one is bigger than the game. And if you start doing that, you're heading down a very, very dangerous path, in my opinion. What I would like to see is you suspend Serena Williams for 6 months. You go, that was unacceptable. It was in a final, global audience, disgraceful behavior. You're out for 6 months. Now, what that will do is, forget the 17,000 and fining of that. What it will do is suddenly the sponsors that sponsor her, and she has a lot, will turn around and go, hang on a sec, we sponsor you to play tournaments.
Yeah.
You're not playing tournaments, we're not giving you as much money. Also, her world rankings will drop because she's not played in those tournaments. Now, therefore, she then has to perform, has to button down to get back up to where she was. But it will affect her pocket that way far greater than a piddly little fine of $17,000 when you have career earnings of $84 million. Now, if you take it in a team situation, we'll just hypothetically say cricket. If you drop a player in cricket and suddenly another player comes in, if it's a batsman and he takes scores 200s or he scores a 75 and 100, are you going to bring the other guy back? No, you're going to say, well, we can't drop him, he's performed. And again, the sponsors will go, look, we're giving you this money because you're meant to be the number one, yet you're not even in the test team at the moment. So sorry, you're going to have to...
Yep.
And that's the only way I think you're going to see these athletes improve their performance and be role models, because they will then toe the line because they have to financially if they want to still be in the top 5 or 10 or be one of the top players in the world, and also if they want the financial rewards that come from being the best from their sponsorship deals.
Yeah, I can't agree with you. I mean, this has been a problem with tennis for a long time, that the fact that these people, you know, what is a fine? $10,000 fine, a lot of them can just not even think about it. Mate, if I got a $10,000 fine, I'd be hocking all sorts of stuff.
Well,
I'd be
here,
in trouble.
Yeah.
I would be in serious financial trouble. So, yes, $10,000 is a lot of money, but not when you've earned $80 million. I mean,
yeah.
$10,000, probably spend that on a chauffeur-driven car ride with whatever the latest, what's that, champagne they all drink these days. It's,
I don't know, Verve?
No, it's not Verve. There's some other brand of champagne all the rappers drink, you know, thousands of dollars a bottle or whatever. Look, there's two issues here. First up, you got caught cheating, Serena. You were cheating. Your coach admitted you were cheating. Now, it's a harsh word to use, so I can imagine why she didn't like, you know, she thought, cheat, I'm not a cheat, but, mate, I cheat on a hockey field every time I walk out there. If I think about it, because I know that free hit was actually 3 yards back, yeah. But I'm going to take it here. I've cheated.
Yeah, everybody does it. You appeal for a ball that you know went off your legs and out of play. You appeal for the throwing in football, you know?
Look, so...
You don't walk when you've edged it in cricket.
All the time. Now, for me, where it started to get out of hand, what we have here is a case of a petulant, well-paid and highly respected sports star
who's on the wane as well.
Yeah, but who's still, and has been, an amazing athlete and an amazing role model. Let's not forget
no
that.
No arguments there.
She just had a moment. She just lost the plot. Highly pressurised situation. At other times, she's shown that she's got a great deal of mental strength to get through those situations. In this occasion, it got a bit too much for her, and she snapped. Now, we've all been there. It's happened to us all. There's no biggie, Serena. You did it. Okay.
You're human.
You're human. That's fine. There's that side of it. Okay, Serena, lost the plot. Take it on the chin. She didn't. Oh, well, it could have gone down as just a little tiny side note on an amazing career where people would have gone, oh, yeah, look, she proved she was a normal human being in this occasion. But no, we had to turn it into something for the agendarists to get onto. Any idiot with an agenda has been jumping on this like crazy. And Serena started when she used language like, oh, well, I'm a mother. Well, I'll tell you now, Serena, being a mother gives you no guaranteed rights of being anything other than having a child. It doesn't guarantee that you have some sort of gain, some sort of moral thing over everybody else. It doesn't change your morals. It doesn't change the way you think about blah, a whole host of things. It's irrelevant. Don't bring your kids into it. You brought your kids into it for no reason at all.
Well, some would say that you have to behave differently as a parent, so you shouldn't throw these tantrums because it sets a bad example for the child. Luckily for her, the child's too young. But the child will watch that in years to come, I guarantee.
But okay, so I can get that because she's under pressure. But then to play the other cards afterwards, the race card and the sex card, the gender card, was just appalling. Absolutely appalling.
I think it took those movements backwards.
I do too.
You know, it was very sad. Look, and I think it was sad that, you know, we're talking about Serena and we should be talking about Naomi Osaka. And that to me is the saddest thing in the whole thing is, for the last 4 days or 5 days, everyone, and even we're doing it, is talking about Serena.
Yeah.
When we should be talking about this young 20-year-old up-and-coming player who'd beaten Serena before, don't forget. You know, and I mean, I did love her press conference when she said, you know, when she went up to the net and she hugged her and she broke down in tears and she goes, I felt like a kid again because she looked up to Serena so much. And I think Naomi Osaka, by the looks of things, is going to be a great champion in years to come. And hopefully she can go on from this and she will have victories in major tournaments where people actually acknowledge her achievement and give her the limelight that she deserves.
But the tribe that's been written and said about the whole incident since it, I mean, people going, oh, it's sexist, you know. Look what happened when John McEnroe did it, and Ilya Nastasi's name was brought up. People, yeah, I remember.
But they had points docked. They got suspended.
I remember.
They got fined.
I remember people like John McEnroe, people thinking he's a twit because of his behaviour. John McEnroe was not a loved player. You know, this idea that he had all of this respect and everybody loved John McEnroe is complete rubbish.
Yeah, I mean, McEnroe is interesting, as you say, very interesting because I think he's gained more respect now since he's been a commentator than he ever had as a player. Although tennis aficionados always respected his talent, they didn't necessarily respect him, the man.
And the other side of it is both McEnroe and his opponents have acknowledged the reasons he was doing it. He was doing the whole Nana bit, not because he had a problem with the umpire or because blah, of X, Y, and Z. He was doing it to upset his opponent because his opponent was getting on top of him in a game. McEnroe has said that.
Hey, but
this is not about... If it is, it's a really, really poor attempt at it.
But if you look at that brilliant documentary about Jimmy Connors when he had that great run at the US Open, and again, his behaviour was always, and he's admitted that, was to throw his opponent off, to get the crowd on his side, to delay tactics, you know, to throw the momentum of the game, to break up that momentum. And let's be honest, it happens in other sports as well.
All the time.
You know?
And we shouldn't take that one, this one incident of Serena's and judge her career.
Absolutely not.
I wouldn't, you know what, she had a moment. We'll just leave it at her having a moment. Oh, but no. Oh, no, this is a sign of the, you know, patriarchal blah, 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 blah. Oh, God, give me a break. And cartoons, really? How else should a cartoonist draw Serena Williams? You tell me what was wrong with what he drew of Serena Williams. How do you draw a black person? Do you actually colour their skin in black or do you leave them opaque so no one can really tell? You know, Serena Williams is built like a tank. Mate, there would be most of the male population would be too scared to get in a ring with Serena Williams. She is such a beast. She is a physical specimen. Brilliant, you know?
Brilliant athlete, powerful woman.
Powerful. How else do you draw that? Serena, her hair. Who knows what she's turning up on top of her head on any given day, because she loves having all sorts of things going on with her hair. It's just ludicrous.
Yeah, look, I think we've talked about it enough.
Oh,
the media's talked about it enough. And we should probably move on.
Hi, I'm Seb Coe, and you're listening to Not The Footy Show.
Yes, you are indeed listening to the podcast of Not The Footy Show. Now, we're moving ahead to our guest on this show. And if ever anyone had a right, as John just said, to do his Nana, Brant Garvey was one of those. Now, he took part, obviously, in the Rio Paralympics and was taking part in the PTS2 triathlon and paratriathlon. And he was actually winning in that, and then the tendonitis flared up and sadly dropped down in the field. Now, he's been preparing for Tokyo, won the gold paratriathlon World Cup in Canada earlier this year, so things were looking pretty good and he was all getting ready, he had sponsors on board, and then suddenly an email arrived in his inbox from the Australian Paralympic Committee telling him that the International Paralympic Committee had decided to drop that event from the Paralympics in Tokyo. There was no other warning from that. They knew some were going to be cut. And the reason it's been dropped, well, one of the things is, the crazy thing is, the PTS2 category for women will still be competed, but the one for men will not be competed. And a lot of the... Yeah. So what it was they wanted to make more events in the triathlon for women so there were equal gold medals for the women as they were for men. So it was based on gender equality, so they had to cut some of the men's events.
Well, not add to the women's.
No. Because the IPC have said there can only be so many medals given out.
Well, surely, so that means that there'll be women competing for a gold medal available in an event that isn't available to men, and vice versa. There must be a men's event that
Women but they're looking at it over the big thing that there will be so many paratriathlon events. They may not be the same categories, but there'll be four medals for the women and four medals for the men.
Gee, they've thought that one through, haven't they?
Well, shall we hear from Brant?
Let's do it.
Brant Garvey, welcome back to Not the Footy Show.
G'day, how you doing, Ashton?
Oh, I'm very well, thanks. Well, it's been a while since we spoke. I think the last time we spoke was when you returned from the Paralympics. And I suppose the first thing to ask is, what have you been up to?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. It kind of felt like a lifetime, but also gone so quickly at the same time. So basically, since getting injured in Rio, I got straight back to work and was training harder and more consistently than I'd ever trained in my life, and just working my butt off towards Tokyo 2020.
And then, of course, you were dealt probably a worse blow than any injury could have given you, I think.
It's been the biggest blindside I've faced in my life so far, and that was, you know, finding out that my disability category was no longer in the Tokyo 2020 Paralympic Games.
How did you find that out?
I received an email from Triathlon Australia, which said that the IPC had made the decision on which classes had a medal spot in Tokyo, and they said that it's exciting news for some and disappointing for others, and then they listed the classes that had a spot, and so you had to read through it and then see and work out that your disability class wasn't in that list, and then that you were no longer going to the Paralympics or had the chance to even go to the Paralympics.
I think one of the things as a sort of layperson watching this is you think, why has it taken so long to make a decision? I mean, the Tokyo Olympics are what, a little over a year, probably a year and a half, maybe a bit more, sort of year and three quarters away. Surely if that decision was going to be made, it should have been made after Rio.
So yeah, I completely agree. I feel like if you can make the decision now, you could make it at the beginning of the 4-year cycle. I think that on that side of things need to be done more professionally. I feel like there's two conflicting values with the Paralympics, and that's the one that started the Paralympics about participation, but now it's the second largest sporting event in the world, which means that there's money involved and people putting their whole life, like you can't, especially in my category, you can't half commit to the Paralympics. You have to go all in, and that means all in financially, time, effort, everything. And so for them to be able to just make a decision halfway through that it's over, it's just not professional.
Well, I mean, that's another aspect, as you said. I mean, you've dedicated your life to the paratriathlon. You've actually been very fortunate to have a lot of big corporations get behind you in that process as you've progressed in the event. I mean, how are they feeling, and how did you tell them that, sorry guys, I'm no longer going to be going to Tokyo?
I honestly think that would have been the most difficult part about the whole scenario was that I had to tell all these companies that had put, you know, time, money and effort into me and this dream, and that it was all over and completely out of my control, and within an instant too. So it was not like there was much of a build up to it. It was like a flick of a switch. It was all done and dusted. So I had to have some tough conversations. But the positive thing that came out of that was that every single person and organization that was supporting me wanted to support me for who I was and not the Paralympics. And so they're just following me with whatever I decide to do next.
I mean, that's fantastic news. But at the same time, I mean, some of those organizations, I'm sure, have built sort of marketing campaigns around you, the person, and obviously your involvement in the Paralympic Games. So suddenly those long-term plans for them have also had to go on hold.
Yeah, exactly. It has to pivot. It has to. We all have to adapt. And I mean, that's one of the unique things about this decision is that all of these athletes, especially the 9 other athletes around the world that are in the same position as I am, that were most likely going to get that spot, because we're all disabled, whether through birth or through some type of accident or trauma, we've had to learn to adapt through our entire lives. And this was just probably one of the biggest and most emotional times that we've had to learn to adapt again.
Now, you mentioned there the other 9 athletes. Do you think that's why your category was kind of eliminated? Because some people go, oh, 9 athletes, that's not very many when you look at the scale now of the Paralympic Games. Do you feel that sometimes that may be the reason, that there weren't enough people competing, and so they go, oh, look, we can drop that and it's not going to cause a ripple in the big scheme of things?
No. So one of the things is we don't have only 10 athletes. We have a lot more than that, and it's just that there would have only been 10 positions available in Tokyo for our class. And so that was the cap. And based on the top 10 ranking, those athletes were most likely to get those positions. The 9 others that I'm talking about. One of the things that doesn't make sense is that our class is one of the most elite. I mean, we have the people in my disability class could probably beat 95% of the world's population in, you know, that are completely able-bodied in this race. And we've had multiple sprint finishes where 2 to 3 athletes are sprinting from the finish line to get first place. And so it's just our race is super elite. And all those guys have been working that 6-plus years, 7 days a week, 2 to 3 times a day training. That's what it takes for triathlon. It's about, you know, depending on what your coach is giving you, it's about a 16 training sessions a week type scenario, which equates to about 26 hours of actual training.
I mean, it just seems mind-numbing because, obviously, like you say, the event is that close. That's what Olympics, Paralympics are all about. People want to see drama. They want to see a closely fought contest. So it just seems really strange. I mean, have you heard anything from the IOC, the IPC, and have they only communicated through Triathlon Australia?
So we get nothing direct from them, so no direct communication whatsoever. And that was one of the worst parts of this whole scenario. I mean, I got 12 hours notice. So I got an email from Triathlon Australia saying that in the afternoon at 5 p.m. they'll make the announcement of what classes are in and what classes are out. So I got 12 hours heads up. The guy from the UK was on a wind trainer when his coach called him in tears. The guy from America found out by us talking about it on Facebook. So there was a group of us all chatting on Facebook about the news, and that's how he found out. They posted it on their website, but they don't do anything to communicate with the athletes directly.
Now, that must be so disappointing because, I mean, they could easily get all of your details. They know they've made that decision. If they contacted each of the governing bodies, how difficult would it be to actually send you guys a letter, even explaining how they reached that decision?
Yeah, look, I think this is really, there's a disconnect there, especially from the IPC.
So where to now for you? I mean, I look back on our journey and I've known you a fairly long time when you were trying basketball and you were trying to find that thing that really fitted you, the personality and something you really loved. And, you know, you shared that story of when you first tried running with your new sort of lower limb and whatever and went flying in the park. I mean, it's been a long journey. And I mean, so what are you going to do now? Are you going to still continue to compete, but just on the world stage?
So I am basically exploring all different options. One of the things that's been really liberating is the fact that I've gone for a run without having to time myself. So that was really refreshing. I've gone for multiple runs with no technology, no KPIs, no measurement, which has been just finding the love for the sport again. So that's been nice. One of the things that is unusual is that at the top 10 of us throughout the world, we are all rivals and fierce competition. But throughout this process, we've all been connected in this grieving scenario. And so we've kind of come together and looking after each other through chatting, basically counseling each other. And I think that we'll do something really exciting together. We'll put something on and we'll race each other and we'll make the most of it and make a positive out of this devastating news.
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, it's a great shame. I mean, is there any possibility that, you know, I mean, I know it's not going to help your cause, but in 8 years' time, it may be back, your category, or is that it now? Because they want to give, obviously, medals to other sports and that there's a limit on how many medals they want to give away.
So I think, unless I make enough of a ripple, that the athletes are going to be in the same situation 2 years out from the next Paralympics, finding out which classes have medals.
And that's unforgivable. I mean, they should be making the announcement, and I would have thought every Paralympic sport would want the announcement made at least post-Tokyo, and then a sort of guarantee almost from the IPC that they won't drop any sports because you're all starting to train for the next games.
I totally agree, and I believe that it's, like I said at the beginning, that if you can make that decision 2 years out, you could make it 4 years out. And so that needs to be the priority, making sure that you let people know before they start dedicating all the resources and funding. I mean, one of the most heartbreaking things for me is there's an athlete who's my competition from Morocco who relocated his two kids and wife to Colorado and was under the US triathlon funding as he was like migrating into the US system. And all of us, every single athlete in my category, once that news was announced, lost their funding. So he then had to, after that, figure out how he was going to support his family in the next month.
Wow. You know, I mean, do they realize the ramifications of that?
Yeah, that's the thing. And, you know, the other US athlete was 2 weeks ago was having that same conversation. He lived in Houston and he was going to relocate to Colorado as well. Not as drastic, but, you know, if that had happened, everything, your whole life was planned around this event. So, yeah, they definitely don't understand.
Do you think, though, I mean, the Australian Paralympic Committee sort of said that they're going to contact the IPC and say, listen, this is not on. We need to decisions made, you know, after the next games before. Because, as you say, it screws up the funding. It screws up the athlete. It screws up so many people's lives. Surely there must be pressure brought to bear by the national bodies around the world to say, look, this is unforgivable. It mustn't happen again.
Yeah, I think that based on my competition throughout the world, I think we'll make them aware of their mistake and make sure that it doesn't happen again.
Well, Brant, it's always great to catch up with you. It's just a shame it's not sort of happier news, but I'm glad to hear you're still going to be competing, and I'll look forward to hearing what the big event is for all of the top athletes in your category.
Yeah, look, I reckon it will be pretty epic, and so I'm excited to see how it unfolds. And I will. I'll keep you in the loop, Ashley.
And is it going to be in Australia? Can you tell us that?
No, I don't know yet. So it's not that I can't tell you. I just don't know. We haven't decided on what we're going to do, but I think it will be pretty special.
Well, Brian, keep your chin up, and there's plenty of us out there that support you, and please keep competing.
Thank you.
This is Gary Lineker, and you're listening to Not The Footy Show.
You are indeed listening to Not The Footy Show, and that was Brant Garvey, the para-triathlete who has had his Tokyo dream shattered. Can't wait to hear what this new event that's going to come up for that they're organising for all the athletes who have lost that Tokyo dream. He wouldn't tell us where it's going to be, but he has promised me he's going to keep us up to date on that one and what's going to happen. But I just think, John, if the Australian Paralympic Committee do not complain, and all the other countries where those athletes are from, and doesn't say this is unacceptable, you cannot pull the pin on people less than 2 years out from the games, because that is just vicious. It's, I mean, as Brant said, you know, he's had sponsors. Luckily, they've all decided to stay with him because they're sponsoring him, the individual, and the Tokyo thing was sort of the cherry on the cake. But there are guys, as we heard in that interview, who'd moved to California to train. Yeah. Now they've lost their funding, and they've got families. What are they going to do? And because they're no longer part of the Olympic program or Paralympic program, so the funding's gone, and they've now got to support themselves, and they've got to find. I just think it's just awful.
Send the International Paralympic Committee an invoice for the last 2 years of effort you put in.
Yeah, that's actually a very good idea.
Send them an invoice and say, I've spent 2 years doing this because you told me that this was going to be an event, and I've just wasted all of my time, my energy, my money. You've just stuffed me around. I want some compensation for this.
But it's like, if you were going to make this decision, you must have known 2 years ago, or you must have been considering it 2 years ago at the Rio Olympic Games. So why couldn't they have made a decision then?
Well, it's poor form to get halfway through an Olympic cycle and decide that you're going to drop a sport.
Absolutely.
And anybody involved in that sport should be absolutely livid that the organisers care so little about the athletes and about the sports themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, and the very fact that, as we alluded to before the interview, that it's a smattering of a fixturing, if you want to call it fixturing, you know, well, the men, we've got the same amount of medals for men and women, isn't that great? Well, no, because you've got men competing over here doing this, they're not even competing in the same events. So, surely if you're going to have a medal, there's a medal for men and there's a medal for women, and that event's in. This event, we're not going to have the men, so the women are gone as well. I mean, how do they work this out?
Makes a lot more sense to me and you, but obviously these sports administrators, who have no doubt got a degree from some university in sports administration, have come up with it. You know, I don't like that one. I think it is...
You know who at this moment would be loving the way sports administrators think?
Who's that?
Usain Bolt.
Oh, of course he would.
He'd be loving it.
He would indeed.
Which I believe you wanted to have a chat about.
Well, no, it's your topic now, isn't it?
I feel a bit conflicted by it, to be honest. I think everybody should have the opportunity. If I thought that I could have a crack at it, I should be allowed to go up to Perth Glory or any other club and say, I think I'm good enough, give us a go. And then it's up to them whether they allow that. They can go, well, actually, you're a hockey player, nick off. Or they could go, oh, well, maybe he can play a bit. We'll chuck him in a trial game. Yeah, look, so that opportunity should be there for everybody, okay?
No argument there.
And that's my base level of opinion on that. So we have Usain Bolt signed up at the Mariners, or going there as a trial.
And I believe being paid to trial.
Being paid to trial, which is very interesting in the world of football. Now, if the Mariners want to sign him up and want to give him a shot, I think that's fair enough. That's up to the Mariners to decide. They're big boys. They're privately owned. They can do whatever they damn well like. But at the same token, there's something wrong about it. There's something that doesn't smell right. He certainly shouldn't be getting any money from the FFA. None whatsoever. No. If the Mariners want to pay him, that's up to them.
You know, and when the Mariners are asking for close to $1 million from the FFA and they're looking to play a guy who's never played football, he's in his 30s,
yeah,
has never played at a decent level, and they're talking about paying him $3 million. What sticks in my craw is how much of that money, if the Mariners actually went in, were serious about developing football, how many, look, there are better 32-year-olds than Usain Bolt in the country.
Yeah,
playing in WA, there's some that are better than him.
Yeah,
you know, in every state around the country, there are 32s. But how many guys are there in their 20s or in their late teens that are being? They would love the opportunity, and yet they won't get that opportunity. But because it's Usain Bolt, it's ridiculous. And now, I was in the UK when it was first announced, and I was doing the hockey there, working for BT Sport, who again, a lot of the crew are involved with the football over there, and they went, "You've just made your league a joke." That was the words. And they said, look, it wasn't very well respected before. And apparently when it's aired over in the UK, and this is the thing, the FFA go, oh, we've got it aired in all these countries. Apparently it's shown at about 3 a.m. yeah, in the UK. So it's not like when everybody's going to sit down and go, ooh, I'll have a bit of the A-League.
Yeah. But, no, I'm just going home for the pub. What's on?
Well, it's just
there's my curry.
Hey, it's a filler. It's a wallpaper broadcast. You know, where TV stations now, especially sporting ones, they're 24 hours, so they have to find slots to just fill gaps, and the A-League is obviously one of those in that market. But the thing that was sad is, you know, they're going, we saw him trial, you know, when he was at Dortmund, and he isn't very good. And yet, and you watch him, I've only seen the footage that's been on TV, and he isn't very good. And that's what I find so sad, is if the Mariners give him a spot, what message does that send to all the young kids who have aspirations to be in the A-League or make football a career in Australia? Now, the Tony Rallis, who's the agent who's been involved in this, now, he was quoted as saying that if Usain Bolt makes it and is given a contract, he goes, and this is quote-unquote, he goes, he will create dreams for young people and he will give the A-League a profile no amount of money can buy. Well, that's a dumb statement, because one is, how is he going to create dreams for anyone, for young people, when he's a sprinter who's been allowed this opportunity that other people wouldn't have been allowed if they didn't have the profile that he had? And the profile, from what I'm hearing, is everyone's going, the A-League's a joke if you're giving a guy who's not a footballer a contract. And then what was it? He goes, no amount of money can buy that. Well, you're paying $3 million, so you are paying for it. So the whole thing,
but he did buy it.
The whole thing is just, I find it embarrassing. It's very, very sad. And it shows how desperate the A-League is to try and get some sort of publicity, to try and get some traction, to try and create some interest. Now, as you know, I wrote a spoof piece about why not bring in celebrities. But I think if you're going to go down this path, let the celebrities pay to fulfill their dream of having a professional football contract. Make Usain Bolt pay $3 million if that's what he wants to do. Say, Usain, you want to play for the Mariners? It's going to cost you $3 million. If, you know, Gordon Ramsay wants to play, it's going to cost you $2 million to get a red card in the A-League.
I like the idea of Rod Stewart. I mean, Rod could probably have carried his weight in the A-League in his prime.
Well, do you remember that Andrew Shue from Melrose Place? We're going back. I mean, again, he was apparently a very good, he was a semi-professional footballer. There's one that, you know, never...
You haven't watched television for a long
time, haven't you? I haven't watched... God, I'm going back 20-odd years now.
Might be a bit more, mate.
Yeah.
That might be the 80s.
Well, I remember his sister in Cocktail, anyway.
Okay. Look, the other side of it is, do you reckon he could get through 90? See, I haven't... He spent the last, what, 10 to 15 years running in a straight line. And maybe occasionally running a big arc, and now suddenly his body's going to be asked to do things that he's never trained for, never been prepared for. I reckon.
And you're going to try and tell a defender's not just going to kick the hell out of him tackle.
I reckon he's going to struggle to get through more than about a quarter of a season without his hamstring going bing, because he's going to be moving in ways and putting. He's got powerful legs, so when he puts that power through his legs, his body's not used to doing the zigzag, dodge, blah, blah, blah. He's used to just going bang.
Yeah, well,
so it'll be interesting to see. Oh, I think injury might cruel it all in the end anyway.
I did like Ernie Merrick's question, but I think it went over a lot of people's heads when they asked him, you know, they said he's having to do a lot of running to get fit. And he goes, yeah, well, he's only used to running for 10 seconds.
That's exactly right. And that's so... Oh, you know what? I'd love to think that he'd come out here and go, can I have a crack at the A-League? And the Mariners go, look, come along, we'll have a look at you. I'd love it if they turned around and said, geez, a bloke can play. Mate, sign here. We've got Usain Bolt. You're not going to believe it. But that's not the messages we're getting out of it. We're getting the, oh, Usain Bolt's wonderful sprinter. What a we're not hearing anything about his soccer or his football ability from the club or anybody close to it. I don't know that they'll give him a contract anyway. It might be all moot.
Yeah, well, I certainly hope they don't.
Well, if the highlights at Fox Sport have been showing of his work, that they've been tagging in social media as fantastic, look at his skill, etc., etc., if that's any, he's not getting a contract. And the reaction to it has been feral.
I just, as I say, I find it just really sad that the Mariners would want to spend $3 million on a guy that is no better than a park footballer, when they could be investing even just a third of that in young talent within the region and making them better and making them have the opportunity to go on and be professional footballers. You know, I just think they've got the priorities horribly wrong.
I agree. Now, you've been away for a little while.
I have.
Did you follow the NRL players on their Mad Monday?
No, I must admit, I missed all that.
Well, I think it's Canterbury Bulldogs. Just a little comment about it, that the media jumped all over them. They got a bit naked on their Mad Monday and some...
Well, they left a sock on.
Yeah, they did. They left a sock on. Let's call their behaviour boorish. I think it's probably, you know, they got drunk, they did stupid things. Not necessarily things that were going to harm society or anything like that. They were just dumb and inappropriate. Gee, have you ever done something dumb and inappropriate in public before, Ashley?
Yeah, when I was younger.
Yeah. So the idea that a group of footballers getting together to drink large amounts of alcohol would do something dumb and inappropriate, well... But
I think the thing, though, John, is, you know, when I did it, I wasn't getting paid money to be a professional athlete. But I do think... No, look, I agree they should be allowed to. And this is where I think the world has gone a bit crazy. And, you know, I don't like cameras in dressing rooms. I think that's wrong. I think players need to have a place that is sanctuary where they can kick a dustbin, swear, throw something across the room and vent their frustration. But, again, there is somewhere they need to let off steam at the end of a season. But I think, sadly, with mobile phones and all these various things, you've got to be careful where you do it. And I think the clubs have maybe a responsibility to hire somewhere, lock them in it, and just go, guys, go for it in here.
You know, and quite frankly, to members of the Australian media that are out there, a bunch of footballers getting pissed and being dumb is not a story.
No, it's not. And the other thing is that if we look and, you know, there's people say, oh, you're stuck in the dark age, but there used to be a mutual respect between the media and the players, in that there were times when you didn't look, and sometimes when they didn't look, I'll admit, was wrong, or they should have reported things. But there were times when, you know, like, is this really a story? If they're just being drunk and mooning each other or doing something like that. Look, I didn't see what it was, I was away. But sometimes I do think we're being given information about things that really, do you care?
No, I couldn't have cared less what they did. Apart, you know... Mad Monday? I've never been on a Mad Monday.
Not, nor have I.
I'm quite happy after the last game of the season to get stupidly drunk with my teammates and
fall asleep at 9 o'clock on Sunday.
Yeah, in my shin pads.
In your beanbag. I've seen you in the beanbag.
Yeah, look, it's a tough one because, you know, no one wants to be involved in boorish behaviour. You want to have a good time with your friends, you have a few beers, whatever. Most of the time it doesn't get out of hand. It's in private, a few jokes, inappropriate language. Everybody's got to be allowed to let off steam at some stage. The fact that they happen to be highly well-paid sports people is totally irrelevant. Absolutely. What, they're not allowed to have fun then? They're not allowed to just blow it off? And don't forget that we're not... This isn't as if we live in a society where no one drinks. It's only professional sportsmen getting drunk. I mean, come on.
Nah, fair enough.
You've been to your average media organisation Christmas party?
Oh, years ago, I remember newspaper parties at Christmas were very... I mean, we...
Don't see the media reporting on their parties, do we?
Nah. I mean, I can remember when I worked for a certain newspaper, the department, we had a breakfast We went from the breakfast to a lunch, and then we went to the complete staff party. So it was a long, long day.
And that happens in private organisations and government businesses as well. So, you know, the media's just got to calm down a little bit. Good to see you again, mate.
Yep, well, don't have a drink and get naked too quickly, all right? I'll see you soon.
I've got the big grand final on Saturday night, so it may very well be happening.
Some people are on the fence. They think it's all over.
See ya. We'll be back next week.